Welcome to Sputnik, orbiting the world with me, George Galloway. Gayatri will be joining me later, but for the moment, we have limited space on the sofa. The cruel and unusual judicial killing of a married couple, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, in the electric chair in Sing Sing, New York, in 1953, leaving their two children orphaned, was a savage landmark in the history of the Cold War. It marked the high or the low point of McCarthyism, the era of witch hunting, blacklisting, and Reds under the beds. When I was myself a young child, I'd hear my own parents whispering the names of the Rosenbergs. The case might, though, have become like Trumbo, locked away in history, of interest only to the cognoscenti, but for the rank element of personal betrayal which led the couple all the way to the chair. It's that, I suspect, just as much as the current tensions between the United States and Russia, which makes the story still capable of packing in theatre audiences at the Southwark Playhouse. Gayatri and I were lucky enough to see the play just the other night, and you still can until the 13th of April, with matinees on Tuesdays and Saturdays. I'm joined now by the acclaimed director of the Rubenstein Kiss, Joe Harmston, and Mrs. Rubenstein, a.k.a. the actress Ruby Bentel. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you very much.
This was a perfectly timed rerun. It premiered in England because, well, we're either in a new Cold War or we're on the verge of it. Yeah. Sometimes I think it might be hot. Tell us why you decided to bring back to the stage the Rubenstein Kiss. And why Rubenstein? Why did you change the name from Rosenberg?
Well, the first thing, in terms of the choice of the play at this moment, we were, Henry Prophet, who's producing as well as playing Jacob Rubenstein, and I were fascinated by, as you say, everything that was happening with Russia at the moment. Although we actually started talking about the play pre Salisbury. So it was kind of the thing that made us absolutely feel that this was the moment to be looking at it. But also in a wider sense, because of the way that across the world, but in, particularly in the UK at the moment, our political positions are becoming so black and white, so divided, and our views are dividing families in just the way that in this drama, the political allegiances that they take and the divisions that are caused by that actually drive them apart.
I mean, you're referring to Brexit, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a very long time since people's normal sort of everyday family political standpoints have really driven people apart and caused huge rifts in families and groups of friends. And I think, you know, in some ways, the fact that we are becoming so politicized again is a very good thing. But there's a cost, and that's very much what James Phillips' play is about, that when you take an absolute political standpoint, there are personal costs.
Ruby, you are, if I may say so, perfectly cast.
Thank you.
As Ethel Rosenberg, a.k.a. Rubenstein. You don't just manage to convey her character as I know it to be. You also even look like her. You're very young. Had you ever heard of the Rosenbergs before this gig came along?
No, not at all. I think I did. There's a picture, a famous picture of them kissing in the police van, which I had seen. But apart from that, no, it was a new story, so I got to look into it all.
And now that you've been playing it every night and twice on Tuesdays and Saturdays, how much has it affected you, the story? It is a very affecting story. We drove home from it in silence.
Yeah.
This is a married couple executed in the electric chair, leaving two orphans. That's not a normal thing, even in the United States.
Yeah, I think often at the end of a rehearsal day, I would come home feeling very, very tense, sort of around my mouth and things, and just that passion that drives her and her husband to do what they do, and their utter belief that they're doing the right thing and that their sacrifices they make for the cause they feel is so important. That it was trying to sort of figure that out. She has a sort of energy. Often before the show, I have to sort of really like psych myself up because I'm like, this woman is so driven. And to find
Well, that's a very good point, because actually I'm one of those that believes that she was the power behind her husband, that she actually was more of a communist than him. She was more committed to the Soviet Union than him, and she drove him to some extent. Did you feel that? Did you play it that way?
I think we, in the story, James has also sort of written that, and she was very political beforehand. She went on strikes and things, and so this was always in her, this political belief, and then finding this husband who had the shared views and who inspired her even more, and I think she is very much sort of the driving force between them.
And he might have capitulated and saved both of them from the chair, but in a very powerful, moving scene, I don't want to give away too much. Stiffen his resolve.
Yeah, I think she has a toughness which maybe Jacob doesn't have, or has moments of where he questions himself and what they're doing, and she is the one who goes sort of like, no, this is the right thing, we're doing this for the right reasons, and yes, it's causing us pain and it's going to be hard, but we need to do this, we're doing the right thing.
It is also very much, and I think, you know, you've just touched on it, it's a play about love, and that drives through, but in a number of ways, because it's very much about their love for one another, which, as you've just been saying, bolsters their political allegiance. But it's also about the fact that their political beliefs come out of a passionate love for their common man. And Jacob has a wonderful, powerful speech when he's being attacked by the FBI about the failings of the Soviet Union. And he just says, but it's our duty to try to campaign for this, for an ideal, for a perfect future. And that has that's a really passionate love.
And he makes
love.
The point that will live on.
Absolutely.
Long after us. By the way, your FBI man is also perfectly cast.
Yeah.
I found him utterly believable as a 1950s G-man. This is interesting for me on multiple levels, politically and geopolitically, but also because it recalls a time at the tail end of which I was alive and active, in which an extraordinary number of Jewish people were on the left, were in the Communist Party. In fact, fascists used to consider it a synonym, the Judeo-Communist conspiracy, they would call it. For a variety of reasons, which we needn't go into, that is no longer the case. But in the audience I was in, there was a very large number of people that I knew to be or thought to be elderly Jewish communists. This, as part of history, pages turn and so on, as I made the point in the introduction, it would just be history, but for the personal betrayal. Yeah. Again, I don't want to give away too much for those who don't know the story. But do you agree with me that in a way that's what gives it a longer life as a piece of work?
I think so, because that's what turns it into a human drama, as opposed to it being an interesting historical story, as you're saying. I mean, that core idea of how does a family actually operate with its members when they are, we're trying not to give away the plot, of course, while it's trying to sort of deal with the divisions that are created by the standpoints that they take. I think that is pure human conflict, and that's what drives the drama. And then, of course, that allows the details of the political story and the historical story to come out. But I agree with you. If it weren't for that, it could be quite arid.
Yeah, only people like me would go to see it. The children left behind grew up, interestingly, for quite a long period, in the custody of the man who wrote Somewhere Over the Rainbow, one of the world's most epic songs. And they remain faithful to their parents. They have never stopped, and they're both old now. They have never stopped campaigning for what they see as justice for their parents. So in that sense, the Rosenbergs succeeded, didn't they? They wanted to be an example. they were an example. We're talking about them
Absolutely.
Now, half a lifetime, more than half a lifetime later. And their children remained faithful to their cause.
I think that's one of the really fascinating things about the way that the story developed. And it's one of the things that Cranmer, who's the FBI character, becomes very aware of, that actually the American government realized by the end of it that they were going to do themselves terrible harm, because what they were going to end up with was creating martyrs to a cause. And of course, the rallies at the time were enormous. And as you say, we're still talking about it all this time later, because they're... I mean, whatever you think about the rights and wrongs of whether they'd done something, their arrest, their prosecution, perhaps fine and arguable, but their execution, they were the only people executed for conspiracy to espionage. And it really, in many ways, it was, as you say, both the height of McCarthyism, it was also the beginning of the end of McCarthyism, because it proved that it had gone so far that it really was going to have to be stopped.
That's a very good point, that whilst it may have been the high point, it was a turning point, because saving the Rosenbergs from the electric chair became not just a national, but an international campaign. And lots of other things were happening at the time, Paul Robeson and others being victimized, blacklisted. Lastly, I don't want to be rude to the Southwark Playhouse, but it's a limited space. We're not talking about the West End here.
No.
I think you did miracles with the limitation of that space. Oh. I was able totally to suspend disbelief about where we were and where we were going next and so on. I wish I could talk to you all day about this, but we're out of time. Up till the 13th of April, with a matinee on Tuesday and Saturday, at the Southwark Playhouse. The Rubenstein Kiss. I promise you, you won't be sorry if you make the trip to see it. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Sputnik.
Thank you, George.
Coming up next, a young British actor and comedian who's really going places. Welcome back to Sputnik. He won the Pride of Britain Award at the age of 12. He was runner-up in Britain's Got Talent at the age of 14. And his film came out yesterday because nothing else was meant to be happening on that day. He's a proper stand-up comedian who's headed right for the top. He's Jack Carroll, star of Eaten by Lions. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to have you on the Sputnik.
Thank you for having me.
We, especially her, were huge fans of Trolley.
Huge
I only watched the movie. She watched every single episode, and more than once, I can tell you. Tell us first about this film, which looks absolutely brilliant. Why Eaten by Lions?
I think so. It's basically the story of two half brothers, one white and one Asian. I'm playing the white one typecast again. And basically, our parents die, so we go to Blackpool to look for Omar's. My character's called Pete, the other lad is Omar. And our parents die, and we go to Blackpool to look for his real dad, who turns out to be a bit of a disappointment. And so it's a buddy comedy road movie. We run into interesting characters, all sort of set in Blackpool.
Yeah, it's a perfect set.
Mm, indeed.
It is Britain in the 70s, if you like. And when I looked at the stills from the film, you're even dressed that way.
Indeed, yeah. They were the only clothes they had available at the B&B run by Johnny Vegas that we end up in. So.
Johnny Vegas is in it too?
Yeah, indeed.
Oh,
yeah.
I can't wait to see it. So now you're in movies. Next step has to be Hollywood. How do you get from West Yorkshire to the verge of Hollywood? How do you win awards at the age of 12?
I don't know. If I had the formula, I'd be selling it door to door, I think.
How did it start at 12? How did you get the
awards? So my parents had their silver wedding anniversary, and I, at 11 years old, I sort of asked if I could perform some stand-up at that evening. And, you know, reluctantly they agreed. And then my uncle...
Risky.
Yeah, indeed, because there was a lot of family and friends there, and it could have been terribly, horrendously embarrassing. But so my uncle filmed that and put it on YouTube, and then that got a few hits, and the local news picked it up. And
well, hits is an understatement. And some of the people that saw it recognised the comedic genius that's within you.
Yeah. That's for others to say. But I mean, it's certainly something I've always enjoyed doing, right from being 2 or 3 years old. Because I think that's the sort of currency a little bit in my house is, you know, can you have a laugh and are you funny and are you quick is the sort of main currency around my way. And I think, you know, it's certainly something I've had an aptitude for from a young age, probably above all else, because I'm no good at maths or any of that sort of thing. So
well, you'll need to count your money in Hollywood. you go on Britain's Got Talent and you're runner-up at the age of 14. What was that like?
Bizarre, because it's like you're trapped in a bubble, and it's sort of a weird consensus reality that everyone agrees that this is the most important thing at the time.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, there's a perception from the outside looking in that those sort of reality shows are in some way exploitative or, you know, difficult to manage. Whereas what I found, I think, was a load of people trying the best to make a good show, which is...
Well, we watch them all, so you're pushing an open door.
Indeed,
Simon Cowell and the whole, if you like, infrastructure which exists above and below these kind of shows, some say that they're rigged or they're somehow fixed. That presumably wasn't your experience.
No, if it was, I didn't get the number one.
You didn't get the gold medal.
Absolutely, yeah. I didn't get the codes to rig it, unfortunately. That's why I only came runner-up. I don't know. There seems to be a sort of general leaning in the human brain, whatever it is, towards conspiracy, don't there? And sometimes...
Because it looks too polished, and they say, it can't be this way.
Yeah,
auto-tuning and... taking, you know, editing things in a way that favour this person rather than
I think
that.
There's definitely a bit of that goes on, a bit of editing, because after all, it's, you know, it's entertaining.
Well, even this is edited. It's edited to make you look hilariously funny.
Absolutely. They'll just cut away to a shot of you now going, ha, 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 and then everyone will go, that's brilliant. Yeah.
Now, what part of your comedic development has been affected, and in what way, by your cerebral palsy?
I was talking about this the other day, and I think it's, I'm grateful for the cerebral palsy, and certainly, you know, I know that's not the case for everyone, because not everyone with the condition, you know, has it the same severity and all that sort of thing. But I think it forced me into verbal communication maybe earlier than others would have had to. So words and communication and getting my point across, it's always been a major way in which I interpret the world and, you know, affect change. So I think it's sort of semi-responsible for, you know, the position I find myself in today.
Just wondering, I mean, there's now a whole range of comedians out there. How do you position yourself among them? How do you compare to them?
I think you've just got to... I don't know whether it's a thing of comparing yourself. I think, you know, if you keep working hard and people seem to respond to the things you do, you eventually carve out your own little audience.
Do you write all your own material, for example?
Yeah, I do indeed. I do indeed.
I think. Would that change if you make it to Hollywood? How would you feel about delivering other people's jokes and funny lines?
Yeah, I think, well, there's certain circumstances where I quite like that collaborative process of, you know, someone coming up with a funny line, and, you know, if you're doing an awards thing. But I think if it's a comedian on stage doing a set in a comedy club or in a theatre, you know, I like it to be the comedian's words.
Yourself, yeah.
Myself personally, but that's, you know, not the same for everyone, because some people are great performers.
You see, you're coming from, in the way that the great early Billy Connolly was, Peter Kay and others, you're coming from the working class. You're coming from the regions. You're not a metropolitan Oxford footlights, as that's Cambridge, I think, graduate. It shows what I know about these places. And of course, so are most of us in the country. Do you think that's what strikes a chord? You see, when in Trolley, for example, I saw lots of characters that I've actually met. And I used to feel the same about Billy when he was on stage talking about the shipyards and the streets of Glasgow and so on. I recognize these characters. He accentuated, of course, the funny things about them. That's the genre, really, that you're ploughing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, because I can see, like, whether I do gigs in up in Scotland or whether I do gigs in Yorkshire, Manchester, those sorts of places, there seems to be a general consensus amongst, you know, that's not to say audiences in London and places aren't good audiences, but there does seem to be a general consensus amongst...
Well, you see, I think, like most things in life, it's class that is the most important identifier. You could have a different hue or tinge to your skin. You can have been born in that county rather than that, but the main identifier in life, in my opinion, is class.
I think that's, you know, true to an extent, as we've seen through history.
Doesn't mean you hate other classes, by the way.
No.
I have some lovely friends in the upper classes and some people I really hate in the working class. But it kind of defines them.
But I think that's an important distinction that people miss out on a lot of times that, you know, that gets sort of swept away with the rhetoric, really. But that is an important distinction to make,
it's not,
I think.
Let me ask you about comedy as a weapon, because let's talk about the early Frankie Boyle, for example. He weaponized humor with pretty devastating effect. Now he's on the BBC and so on. He's a kind of different animal in my view.
You haven't seen him live recently then?
No.
It's
live still, different?
Still the same old Frankie, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that. Because the best comedy is neither left nor right. It's neither Labour nor Tory. It's subverting the prevailing orthodoxy for laughs, making people laugh at themselves. Trust me, if I wrote material to lampoon the British left, it would be a big show, I promise you. Don't you think the point about comedy is not that it punches down all the time, or even punches up all the time, but that it's capable of doing both?
Yeah, of doing both to suit, I think, the point that's been made. Comedian has to be elastic on stage. I think you can hold views in your private life, you know, a coherent set of values, but on stage I think you've got to be elastic and alive to other viewpoints and take it all in and, you know...
Slightly anarchic, would you say?
Yeah, I think that is The fact that you're trying to subvert and be a little bit contrarian oftentimes is that you've got to have that sort of spirit and go on stage. That's the comedy that I like.
So the film is out, starring you and Johnny Vegas. Who's Omar, by the way? Who's playing him?
An actor called Antonio Keel.
It sounds fantastic. Is it on general release? Will you see it on your multiplex everywhere?
Yeah, so it's in cinemas sort of all over the UK and Ireland, and it should be good, I think.
Wonderful.
Any American interest?
There is, but I'm not sure whether I'm allowed to say it yet. But there is.
I honestly, I have a very, and I'm good at these things. I have a very clear feeling that you're going to make it on the other side of the ocean too. I think you're a very big star, and I'm just glad we caught you on the way up. Be nice to us, because you'll meet us again on your way down. Carol, thank you very much.
Thank you ever so much for having me
on the Sputnik. And now it's your turn to tell us what you think through the portals of social media. What's rattling, Gayatri?
Right, so about the Rubenstein kiss, we ask whether McCarthyism in the Western countries is heading back to the era of the Rosenbergs. And Hilary Jacobian says, this is how the establishment destroyed the left and continues to keep progressives at bay. Blackmail and labeling individuals and groups as dangerous communists.
Well, although, as Joe Harmston was just pointing out, actually, the Rosenberg atrocity, the murdering judicially of a mother and father leaving two orphans, actually broke McCarthyism. And eventually, an act of McCarthyism in the West, in Britain, in America, will, I think, equally turn out to be the point at which people say, enough is enough.
And is it enough?
I think so, yeah.
Well, that's all the tweets we've got time for today, then.
Which, alas, means that's the end of the show.
But you can stay in touch with us on our social media, on Twitter and Instagram, RT_Sputnik, or on Facebook, Sputnik on Russia Today. It's goodbye from me, Gayatri.
And from me, George Galloway. It's been marvellous.